Welcome to the Bova UK podcast, where we will be discussing diseases from diagnosis through to management. These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon. Hello and welcome to the latest Bova UK podcast. Today we've got Dr. Roseanne Jepson and Dr. Sarah Caney discussing the whys and hows of phosphate restriction in cats with CKD. Roseanne is an Associate Professor in Small Animal Internal Medicine at the Royal Veterinary College. Roseanne is a recognised RCVS, ACVIM and ECVIM specialist in Small Animal Internal Medicine and is currently the co-head of the Small Animal Internal Medicine Service. Her particular areas of interest include canine and feline nephrology, urology and systemic hypertension. Dr. Sarah Caney is the CEO of Vet Professionals and has worked as a feline-friendly vet for more than 20 years. She is a University of Bristol graduate and also completed her feline medicine residency and PhD at this institution. Sarah has worked for many years with the UK cat charity, International Cat Care, and the International Society of Feline Medicine.
It's a real pleasure for me, Sarah, here today with Roseanne, because many years ago, Roseanne was a student at Bristol when I was a very young lecturer, and it's been an absolute pleasure to watch your career since then, Roseanne, and an inspiration to me, really, for all the work that you and your wonderful colleagues at the RVC have done to advance our knowledge on chronic kidney disease in cats, and an absolute pleasure for me to be here with you today and have the opportunity to learn from you and quiz you, as well as hopefully bounce some ideas into the sort of wider listening audience from our discussions. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this podcast with me.
No, thank you, Sarah. I have to say that you were part of an inspiration for my career. So I have to say that without you and meeting you at Bristol, I would not necessarily have got onto this track. You were definitely a big part in the career that I've had so far. And I'm really honoured to be doing this podcast with you today. I'm really excited to talk about phosphate regulation and what we can do for the older cats.
Absolutely fabulous. So let's get to it. Obviously, you and I for many years have been talking with our veterinary colleagues at CPD events and writing articles and papers, etc., about how important phosphate restriction is in our renal patients. But I'm just going to throw right at you now, where you are sitting now, having been working in this field actively for many years. You've published widely, but obviously there'll be lots of things that are ongoing that not quite published yet. Where are we currently and why is this still such an important aspect of our management of our renal cases?
I think we have to take it a little bit back to first principles into why we're worried about phosphate to begin with. And if we remember that as cats develop chronic kidney disease, obviously the many functions of the kidney start to change and decline. And one of those is the ability of the kidney to get rid of waste products. And one of those obviously being phosphate. So as kidney function starts to decline, we do start to see various changes that happen, hormonal changes, but also excretory capacity of the kidneys. And so we start to have problems with phosphate regulation. And there's been a lot of work ongoing over many years now trying to better understand what the sort of regulating factors may be. But I think fundamentally, one of the most important findings many years ago now was that by regulating phosphate homeostasis, we can improve the outcome of cats with chronic kidney disease. And the way that has traditionally happened has been by regulating the amount of phosphate that we feed cats in their diets. And that work, which started over 20 years ago now, is still ongoing today. I think as we start to appreciate that it's not just those cats in the later stages of chronic kidney disease where we need to be aware of both phosphorus and calcium homeostasis, but also as we diagnose cats at earlier time points. And in the last decade, there's obviously been a big push towards how do we diagnose at an earlier time point. And then as vets, we have these secondary questions. Having made these earlier diagnoses, what are we going to do about it? And when does starting to feed a renal diet become important?
Absolutely. I'm so pleased to hear you raise those questions so early in the discussion, because I think that's a key thing I wanted us to have an opportunity to talk about a bit more. Is we know phosphate restriction is helpful in terms of prolonging lifespan, improving quality of life, but at what point do you think we should intervene, and with what magnitude of phosphate restriction? Because obviously in recent years we've had now these early renal diets appear. So what's your perspective on, firstly, what time point should we introduce a phosphate-restricted diet to our CKD patient?
So in terms of the point at which we're instituting the sort of more traditional renal diets, or the commercial renal diets, then that tends to be the azotemic population of cats. So here we would be talking about iris stage 2, 3 and onwards, and they're the cats where we're really starting to see maybe an increase in phosphorus as you're looking at your biochemistry profile. So these are cats that have elevated urea, creatinine, SDMA, and their phosphorus may be going up as well. But with the ability for us to recognize kidney disease at earlier time points, so here we might be talking about those cats that have SDMA but their creatinine might be top end of the reference interval, perhaps not yet elevated, or we might be looking at those cats where we've identified changes on their ultrasound and they've had persistently declining urine concentrating ability. So we're recognizing them at a much earlier time point. Those are the cats which we're perhaps now tending towards using some of the early renal diets, recognizing that the sort of more traditional commercial renal diets are more manufactured for the later stages of chronic kidney disease. So I do think that we're looking towards making early kidney disease recommendations in terms of dietary change, but that the more stringently phosphate restricted diets that we might think of using historically are not necessarily going to be appropriate all the way through from stage 1 through to stage 4. And we're seeing this reflected in the diets that are available on the market. So a large number of the different manufacturers are now, as you said, producing the earlier renal diets, recognizing that the sort of nutritional requirements of those cats are different from an older healthy cat, but they're also different from the stage 3, 4 heading towards later stage kidney disease cat as well. But there's still a lot of active research going on in that area, I think, really to try and help us understand exactly what the nutritional requirements are of those early stage cats and whether we can impact survival and outcome in the way that we know from clinical studies that have been performed we can impact the sort of iris stage 2, 3 and 4 chronic kidney disease cats.
Excellent. And I was going to ask you more about some of the active research, because, and really just if you could expand a little bit on what are the potential concerns or the potential drawbacks of putting perhaps a stage 1 cat onto a more traditional therapeutic renal diet, the more sort of severely phosphate restricted food. What do we need to be worried about?
I think we need to recognise that there are some things that make it easier to transition cats early onto renal diets. So things like they tend to have a better appetite. But some of the traditional renal diets are very phosphate restricted. And today we're doing a lot of work looking at the ratio of calcium and phosphorus in those diets and the potential risk that if we reduce phosphate intake too much, that this could have a potentially negative effect on the calcium phosphate balance in those cats. So we're doing a lot of work looking at hypercalcemia as well. And that's something which obviously we want to typically avoid in cats where possible. So that's some ongoing work that we have at the moment that we're really just looking into to try and inform our decision making processes in terms of the balance that we might optimally have for those early CKD cats. And I think there's a lot of interest at the moment as well in what the degree of protein restriction, for example, should be in those early renal diets, because we certainly want cats to maintain body condition and particularly muscle condition. We know that's going to impact their quality of life in terms of their mobility, and we certainly don't want to see the early onset of sarcopenia, for example. So it is important that we get the sort of protein content as well as the sort of phosphorus calcium balance right in those early renal diets.
Yes. And one of the challenges as well that people ask about is how to manage those multi-cat households where there are multiple animals with differing needs. And should we, in a healthy cat, should we worry about that cat eating a renal food? What tends to be your advice in those situations in terms of the practicalities of offering a therapeutic diet in a mixed household?
Really important question, and also one that's really difficult. It's something which I tend to discuss quite carefully with the clients and trying to understand the setup that they have in their household. Basically, I think the bottom line is that if we're talking about a truly mixed feline household where we've got young cats through to older senior cats, then we don't want the young cats to be eating a phosphate restricted renal diet throughout their life. And so that would not be appropriate. So then it would be looking at ways that we can perhaps self-rate to feed and try and ensure that's not happening in the long term. Now, if they happen to get hold of a small amount of renal diet on one particular day, that's not going to be a problem for them. It would be more of an issue to me if it was somebody who was putting down a traditional renal diet and that was the only diet that was available for the cats in the household. On the other hand, if we were to have an older senior cat and we were feeding a more of a mixed diet, so maybe they were having renal in conjunction with other senior diets, and we've got a general population of older cats in the household, that's probably going to be okay, even if it might not be what we would say was gold standard perfect. It's always about having a balance. It's about working out what's best for the cats that you're trying to manage, the owners, their lifestyle, their household environment as well, and recognizing that we have to work with all of those challenges, basically. Would you say similar?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. You have to be sensible and pragmatic as well, don't you? But yeah, I totally would follow the same principles, and which sort of leads neatly on as you were talking. I was thinking, yes, what I would like to ask next is really what should we expect for compliance to a therapeutic renal diet? What's your view on that in terms of talking to clients, and also what are your tips for achieving good compliance to a therapeutic diet?
Yeah, so it can be really challenging. I've mentioned already, I think, that making those changes in earlier stages of CKD can be a lot easier than in later stages where obviously appetite can be dwindling. But we're in a much better position now than we have been historically because of the different range of renal diets that are available on the market. Historically, it might have been one of two different renal diets. There'd be just one dry, one wet. And you were really, if they didn't want to eat that one diet, we really struggled as vets. Whereas today, that's not the case. There are so many different renal diets and different formulations that are available that I think it's often about ensuring that we have a lot of potential variety for the cats. In terms of introducing them, then it's all about being gradual, not making rapid changes. When we start a renal diet, it's about the long term. It's not about the short term. So if it takes 2 to 3 weeks or even a month to transition a cat gradually over onto a renal diet, then that's absolutely fine because we're looking at this improving quality of life and longevity for months to years, not days to weeks. And mixing with the cat's regular food, I think, is important as well, or making sure that they've got both options obviously available. And recognizing ultimately, and this is particularly important, I think, for the later stages of cats, that some is better than none. So whilst in an ideal world, of course, I'm going to say, yes, I'd like them to eat renal diet 100%. The bottom line is that many cats just won't do that. But if they will eat up to sort of 50% of a renal diet and 50% maybe of a food that's manufactured for senior cats, so there's a lot of foods on the market that which will be labelled as senior, then these tend to be halfway house, I think, really between a mature cat and a sort of renal diet type food. So mixing those together can also be beneficial. And then I guess as we're getting into the later stages, it's about how else can we support nutrition? And that's when perhaps some of the medications that are available to us now, I think we're a lot more proactive with the use of appetite stimulants. Things like mirtazapine can be really beneficial for owners to have, and also antiemetics as well, particularly getting towards later stages of kidney disease. Did you have any top tips that you like to use with clients as well?
I think it echoes very much what you've said, in that I always say to them, it's about the long term. It's not a short term plan, because it's the rest of the cat's life that ideally we're going to be doing all we can always to constantly optimize the proportion of therapeutic food that cat is eating. And it will tend to go up and down with time as well, as the cat might have setbacks or other health issues that impact on it. So it's all about, I think, in my view, managing expectations, making sure that they're not daunted by that, that they feel that sadly is what they should expect, is to be unfortunately throwing away some uneaten food, feeling a little bit frustrated, but that every effort that they can make definitely will be worth it in terms of that cat's quality of life and length of life. So it's worth sticking with it and experimenting with, yes, different formulations, different flavours, different brands, all those tactics. And as with you, just making sure that we as clinicians have thought about all of the possible causes of poor appetite associated with that cat's renal disease. So we've addressed that nausea and vomiting, the dehydration, all of the fixable things. So we get as many things working on our side as we possibly can. I guess another thing that I find helpful, and I think you do from having heard you speak about this previously, is knowing that if you look at the publications about use of therapeutic diets and what can be achieved, you can see that often the compliance reported in those publications is very high, often approaching 100% in some studies, because the therapeutic food was provided to those clients as an incentive to them participating in a clinical study. And therefore, the owners are doubly incentivized in terms of successfully transitioning their cat to the food, because it's free as well as being recommended. And I think that's a useful thing to also mention to clients, in that perhaps not in quite those terms, but just to say, really, it is possible. There are these studies where people achieve these. You can do this too, and I will help you get there. And if you don't quite get there, but you're still feeding some therapeutic food, you're doing a brilliant job. And you can only do what you can do. Ultimately, we have to be practical as well.
Absolutely. But I think the check-ins are also important as part of that, because the other thing that can often come with the clinical studies, which I do think in veterinary practices we can also strive towards as well, is using our nursing team to help us in terms of checking in with clients about how are they getting on with the transition to new diets, and particularly in the older cats that are going to become regulars at the clinics, having that additional level of support where somebody's able to talk through with them when they are struggling with a particular diet, and they're, you know, do they need to switch to another one, do we need to think about adding some dry as well as wet, or that can be really useful. And that's something else which I do think that they get as part of the studies, which really helps them, because they know that there's somebody who they're going to speak to maybe on a monthly basis, for example, who's going to just check in about how everything's going. And that additional layer of support can be a really nice role, I think, for somebody to take over within a practice that perhaps already has established geriatric cat clinics, and where there may be a nursing team that's already actively involved.
Yes, totally agree with that. And I think that the more you can empower the owner to be part of the clinical team, and so have them monitoring things like how much is the cat eating at home. A lot of my owners, I managed to persuade to buy some inexpensive scales so they can monitor the cat's body weight at home, so that even without that sort of stressful vet visit and overdoing the vet visits, as in we wouldn't want these poor cats to have to come and see us every week, but nonetheless, it's really useful if perhaps when we see them, perhaps after a month, the owner has got some weekly weight readings, perhaps some monitoring of how much food they're eating. And through that, I think those regular checkups as well, we can drip feed our education and really train the owners to be that part of the team. And nurses are really superb at doing this as well, and really get brilliant results, I think, through that for those owners that are wanting to make that commitment, of course, and perhaps not every owner is able to, but those that do want to, I think it really does boost the response that you get, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And towards the latter stages as well, it's just recognizing and allowing owners to understand that actually there does reach a point where sometimes just having nutrition is the important thing. And if you've had very compliant owners who've worked really hard to ensure that their cat has eaten a renal diet, towards the later stages, it can become quite distressing for them when actually the cat's turning its nose up at the diets that they've eaten all the way along, and helping them to accept that actually that's okay if at the end they're going to just eat regular food because that's what they want to eat. Taking in nutrition at some point becomes the most important part.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes. And in terms of owner discussions as well, I find that it can be, although I guess we all know as people how important diet is in our lives, and there's more and more coming out even in the sort of newspapers about the microbiome and its impact on our own health. But nonetheless, it can seem to some owners quite a leap to say that this food is going to be the thing that makes the biggest difference, because perhaps they're imagining there is some magical pill or injection that is going to answer all of their cat's problems. Do you have any tips for really explaining, particularly thinking beyond phosphate, really, why these therapeutic diets are potentially so helpful for a cat with kidney disease?
Yeah, I think I certainly do try to explain to owners that there have many different benefits. You know, so the diets that are formulated for cats with either early or later stage chronic kidney disease have a number of things that perhaps have brought about that longevity. We talk about it specifically, obviously, in relation to phosphate, but actually the studies that happened, they didn't just change phosphate. They added potassium to those diets. They made sure that they were slightly alkalinizing. They supplemented them with polyunsaturated fatty acids. So the renal diet they're a collection of modifications to a diet, which through the sort of clinical studies that have taken place have shown improved survival. And I think it's about trying to help owners understand that there are many reasons why it may be beneficial for their cat to be on a renal diet, and helping them to understand that really, I think, definitely helps improve compliance along with all of the other potential changes. But I think you hit on a really good point about saying that this all has to be gradual, and too much information at the first time point when you're making a diagnosis of chronic kidney disease can be too much, particularly if at the same time we're also perhaps talking about hypertension and proteinuria, and it can be information overload essentially at the beginning if you're not careful. So that sort of drip feeding, as you were saying, about making small changes initially, prioritizing the information, I think, is important.
Yes, yeah, no, I agree. So we've obviously spoken a lot about the therapeutic diets, I think with good reason, because they are the most proven for improving quality of life and length of life in cats with CKD. But another way that we can have an impact on phosphate and achieve phosphate restriction is through use of oral phosphate binders. And I guess just to start that discussion off a little bit, when do you choose to use phosphate binders in your renal patients?
So we'll think about using phosphate binders. And I guess just to recap, by phosphate binder, we mean a product that is given by mouth and which is going to bind phosphate within the food. So it's given at the same time as we give a meal, and it binds phosphate within the food, within the intestinal tract. So it prevents absorption of phosphate from the intestinal tract. And we start thinking about using them when we're still seeing progressive increase in phosphorus despite cats already being on a phosphate restricted diet. So that would be the typical time when we're using them. Most often that would be in middle to later stage 3 and stage 4 CKD, where cats have perhaps been on a traditional renal diet for a period of time, but we're starting to see that we're no longer hitting the phosphate targets that have been recommended by IRIS, being the International Renal Interest Society. And it's worth just mentioning that the targets for phosphate by IRIS stage are going to be slightly lower than your laboratory reference interval is going to be, because they're targets that have been produced as a result of clinical studies, essentially looking at cats and their phosphate regulation. So don't be surprised that the targets given by IRIS are slightly lower than your top end reference interval.
Do you ever recommend phosphate binders for cats immediately post-diagnosis, those stage two cats, or would you only use them in those cats if it's really impossible to transition them onto a therapeutic diet?
I try not to use them in the early stage cats. I will persevere for quite some time to try and transition cats onto a renal diet, mainly because the typical feline diets have high levels of protein and therefore have high levels of phosphorus. So the volume of phosphate binder that one would need to give with every meal, I actually think is more challenging oftentimes than transitioning those cats onto a renal diet. You're right, though, that there is at least one small study which suggested that potentially it can be beneficial, but on the whole, I definitely prefer to try and get them onto a renal diet if I can. And they're really therefore used as an add-on or an adjunctive. We would be keeping cats on a renal diet and then adding a phosphate binder on top of that.
Yes, I will confess that I personally have used phosphate binders myself for those earlier cases, really in the situation I described, which I think you probably know, slightly devil's advocate, cheekily asking that question there. But really, I guess my rationale in those cases is those situations where perhaps the owner is really not convinced they want to try a therapeutic diet, or where it's really just for whatever reason, perhaps this is a cat that has particular dietary requirements elsewhere. I've had the odd cat with allergic skin disease that the owner said, I don't want to change the food. And so I have used them in that situation. Yeah. But it's certainly, like you, my preference very much is to use the therapeutic renal diets for all the benefits that we've talked about. As you were talking as well, it reminded me, you mentioned the importance of binder with every meal. And I think that's something that's worth emphasizing, because some of the packaging for some of the phosphate binders that have been available commercially to us as clinicians for some time is a little bit, in my view, a bit misleading, in that there is a sort of twice daily dose off on the side of the packet, which then implies that this is something that is given every 12 hours as opposed to something that needs to be given with the food. And certainly my preference is to divide that daily dose, which ultimately is fairly arbitrary, across all of the meals and have that as a starting point. Acceptance of phosphate binders, is that something that you have particular tips for? Obviously, there's a variety of formulations. There's some liquids, some powders. But do you have any tips for acceptance?
Phosphate binders, I think, are one of the hardest medications to administer to cats, which I think is partly where my preference to trying to get them onto a renal diet comes from. So I think if there's anybody out there who's worked out the magic solution to this, then I'd definitely like to hear from them. With wet foods, I think it can be easier because things like powders and liquids obviously can mix in more easily than going on to dry foods. So for cats that eat wet foods, it's possibly slightly easier, I think. Unfortunately, because we're often adding these to our stage 3-4 CKD cats, where anything that can put them off their food can be a sort of inhibitor again to wanting to eat that food. I think that really is one of the challenges around the phosphate binder. So I don't think I have an answer. Some of them are relatively inert, I think, in terms of flavor, and that's beneficial. If we have phosphate binders which come with palatable flavors, that can sometimes be beneficial. Historically, there have been some human phosphate binders which were very unpalatable in flavors for cats, and that was a definite disadvantage. So I think the inert powders that mix in with wet diets probably the easiest combination, but I recognize fully that there are some cats out there that a wet diet, if they've eaten dry their whole life, is just not what they're going to want at all, and adding a powder to crunchies is difficult at the best of times.
Yes, it is tricky. It's actually a question that I did a survey of UK owners of cats with kidney disease a few years ago through vet professionals, and we asked about their experience of phosphate binders. And I can't remember the precise number of owners that had experience of using the phosphate binders. There were about 850 owners in total in the survey, but not all of them had used binders. But those that had, probably about two-thirds of them said acceptance had not been problematic. problematic. And we did ask what their tips were, actually. And my favourite tip, which you alluded to, actually, your answer was add to the food when the cat isn't looking. This whole concept that we know that cats don't like their food being tampered with, which you mentioned in your answer. And it's so true, I think. It's like trying to hide the gabapentin in the cat's food when it pre-vet visit and that the cat is quite, you know, be viewing you with suspicion. Yeah. So that was one of my favourites. But other ones on the list that these owners had found helpful were all very sensible ones, actually. So they were things like start with a low dose and gradually increase. So get that sneaky homeopathic dose accepted and then gradually increase from there. There were some people actually who were using powders. I think at the time, the main powders available were epacetin, but also aluminium hydroxide capsules were still readily available at that point, and people were adding that to a small bag of dry food, shaking it up, so to coat the dry biscuits with some of that powdered binder. As you've mentioned, some of the products that are designed to be palatable are palatable, but obviously if the cat does not like whatever flavor, then that can be counterproductive, sadly, as well. And some people were actually putting small amounts of powder into empty gelatin capsules and actively feeding the cat. And if the cat ate, they would immediately dose it with the gelatin. Mm-hmm. Obviously there's a little bit of digestion of that gelatin capsule needed. It may not be quite as optimal, but just a few examples of the sort of innovations that some of these owners found helpful.
Definitely, definitely.
And do you have a preference for, obviously there are a number of different phosphate binders available. Do you have a preference for which product is, in terms of active ingredients, are preferred for phosphate restriction in your patients?
Historically, we've used a lot of aluminium hydroxide, which would classify as one of those sort of more inert powders lacking in flavours, which has typically been quite well tolerated, has some potential advantages. You mentioned epacetin, which obviously contain chitosan and calcium carbonate, and the sort of other calcium containing phosphate binders. I guess we just need to be conscious of the calcium in those cats if we're using calcium containing products. So that's something which, at least on a routine biochemistry profile, it would be nice to know that their total calcium was normal and not towards the top end of the reference interval before progressing with those. Although in recent years, it's been more challenging to acquire aluminium hydroxide. So there's been more of a trend towards using some of the calcium containing phosphate binders, but aluminium hydroxide is certainly the product that I've got the most experience with, and I think has been reasonably well tolerated, certainly in the feline clinics that we run. There are obviously some other human phosphate binders that have been used. Lanthanum carbonate would be one example there. Historically, those were more expensive. I think an advantage of aluminium hydroxide historically was it was relatively inexpensive, and so again, that was beneficial for more general use. Yeah, so I guess that's been my typical experience. There have been products that have come and gone off the market over the last sort of 10-15 years, and I think keeping up with what products are available has been quite challenging at times as well, to be honest, as things have come and gone.
And what should we expect in terms of success of these? How do you monitor patients in terms of trying to determine whether whatever dose of phosphate binder you've started with is adequate and doing something? What's your general approach to that?
Yeah, so I guess as we've said with renal diets, it's the same with adding on a phosphate binder. The changes that we're looking for are going to happen relatively slowly. So we're not looking for a rapid reduction in phosphorus concentration. So ideally, you would have a baseline. So you would perhaps already have transitioned the cat onto a renal diet and you'd have recognized that phosphate was higher than the iris target. And so you were wanting to do something about that. So you'll have a sort of baseline number where you're starting at. And having then added a phosphate binder, I wouldn't recheck things probably for 4 to 6 weeks, having made that change, but then essentially rechecking a biochemical profile at that point and looking to see whether you've had the desired effect and you've now brought your phosphorus down within the target, and then tweaking the amount of phosphate binder essentially in accordance with that. And I think most of the phosphate binders, the sort of dosing ranges tend to be quite wide, and I would typically start at the lower end with scope to move upwards. There are, with all of the phosphate binders, potential side effects, as there can be with any drug. So it's important that we are cognizant of how much the phosphate binder we're giving. Also cognizant, I think, of any body weight changes that are happening to the cats over the time where we may be incrementally changing things. It is important, but it's slow changes and monitoring, but not excessively monitoring. So after any sort of dietary or phosphate binder change, really a month would be the minimum time before I would be looking to reevaluate that change.
And would you typically monitor calcium as well as phosphate? Thinking of perhaps those situations of where funding is a little bit limited, is it important to monitor calcium levels as well through treatment?
I think that's going to depend on which phosphate binder you're using. If you know that your total calcium was fine at the outset and you don't have any concerns and you're using aluminium hydroxide, then if you were really having to only monitor what you could, then you could probably get away with a mini renal panel that didn't include total calcium. I think it's difficult these days. Sometimes it almost feels like a full biochemistry can end up being less expensive than choosing and picking your analytes, which is not necessarily always best medicine. But if it's cheaper for you to do a mini renal panel, then I guess phosphate is going to be the number one thing that you're looking at. If you've transitioned onto a calcium-based phosphate binder and you have the option, at least at some point after starting that, I think just to check in and see that it hasn't gone up, then at least you feel like you've done your due diligence in terms of not being as concerned about the development of hypercalcemia. But it does have to be within the finances. And on the whole, I think phosphate binders tend to be relatively safe because of some of the difficulties that we've said in terms of administering them. So it is actually quite hard to give high doses of phosphate binders to cats because they don't particularly want to eat them. So I think that's we have to be cognizant of the potential for calcium containing phosphate binders to cause problems. But if we can monitor it, I think they're safe.
Yeah. And have you ever sent phosphate levels too low? Is that something that you've ever managed to achieve?
I haven't personally managed that. No, have you?
No, I don't think I have. No, I just thought it was worth asking there because, yeah. I guess usually with our renal patients, sadly, it's the sort of battle against time. It's more the opposite issue, which I guess is a good opportunity to ask another question, which is if you've reach what you think is a sort of sensible maximum dose of phosphate binder and it's still not fully controlling things, are there other strategies that can be considered to help phosphate restrict that patient?
So I think for me at that point, I then look again at what is the sort of proportion of renal diet to regular diet that cat might be eating. Are there ways that I can tweak and increase the phosphate restricted diet as well as the phosphate binder? When you look at the commercially available renal diets, they're not all the same, and some of them are more phosphate restricted than others. So sometimes there is a potential to change to perhaps what is a more stringent phosphate restricted renal diet. I typically don't push too much beyond adding in multiple phosphate binders, mainly because if we're reaching this point, it's normally sadly towards the end of stages of chronic kidney disease. And by this point, there's normally a lot of things that we're tinkering with at the same time. So we're dealing with nausea, perhaps vomiting, appetites dropping. We're starting to talk about, are we going to use subcut fluids? Are they managing to maintain hydration status? We might be needing to use laxative products. So all in all, there's a lot going on normally by the time we're reaching this point. So I tend not to push on multiple phosphate binders, I think.
Yeah, it can often get quite overwhelming. And I think going back to something you said right at the start, it is it can be, I think, a huge emotional burden for these clients at the time of diagnosis, but also in the latter stages as well, when unfortunately you can see that in spite of everything that has been done, things are continuing to progress. And so, yeah, I would agree with you. Often it's a point where you prioritise other things in terms of the cat's short-term quality of life. Going back to the monitoring of the phosphate restriction, though, and your patient's parathyroid hormone assessment, is that, I know that's something that obviously your research will have taken you very much into, but often financially, let alone from practical or other reasons, it's beyond most of us in terms of our day-to-day monitoring of patients. But what is the potential value, and are there situations in which you would encourage clinicians to look at PTH assessment?
So I would say largely PTH within the remit of chronic kidney disease is a research-based tool, to be honest. I think in terms of the stage-specific management introductions that we can make, I think we can make those without needing to go through that additional expense of having parathyroid hormone specifically measured, because I don't think it's going to make any changes really to the recommendations that we're making. In recent years, from a research perspective, we've been doing a lot of work looking at something called fibroblast growth factor 23, which actually is another phosphaturic hormone. So it's just like PTH, it helps the kidney to excrete phosphorus. And actually, more than PTH, that seems to be elevated earlier in the course of chronic kidney disease. So whether in the future we'll see that being taken up as part of our sort of panel for the diagnosis of early renal disease, or perhaps more importantly, those cats that might benefit more from those early renal diets. So, for example, if we were able to identify cats that felt were at risk or within, for example, Irish stage 1 CKD, it may be that those cats with more elevated FGF23 perhaps could be cats that benefited from a slightly different diet to those that didn't. But this is very much at a sort of research stage at the moment, and it is not a test that's available commercially. So it's a research tool at the moment. But it could be that something that I think may become available one day in the future and might add to our panel. But in terms of PTH, no, I guess that's something that I think about if I'm worrying about primary hyperparathyroidism versus renal parathyroidism, hyperparathyroidism, but it's not something I would routinely perform. You would be similar?
Absolutely. And it's really interested to hear your comments on FGF23, because that was going to be my next question. And I don't know how complicated the assay is. Do you think it is the sort of test that could be commercially developed with ease? Because it does seem quite interesting from that perspective.
So it's an ELISA, so it's a relatively straightforward assay. There are some patent-related reasons, I think, why it's not being immediately commercialised. It very much is a research tool at the moment. And we're able to run the assay for the cats that we're seeing through our research clinics, but even there, we're running it on a research basis. So we will be batch analyzing rather than using it for week to week, month to month diagnostic and then management changes. So it's very much being used to explore changes that we're making in terms of the management of cats with chronic kidney disease, rather than informing on an individual cat basis. So maybe one day, but yeah, not sure when at the moment.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And anything else, thinking of future horizons that you're working on or that you're aware others are working on that perhaps we should be keeping our eye out for in the future, or any thoughts that you have in terms of where this is going?
Yeah, I've got colleagues who are super interested in renal mineralization and the differences that there are between those cats, for example, that present with mineralization within the kidney versus true ureterolithes or nephroliths, so stones forming, and the differences that we see there, both in terms of where those mineralizations are occurring, but also the sort of demographic differences and the fact that I think if you see a cat presenting at a much earlier age than we might typically expect, with an average age of azotemic CKD being somewhere between sort of 12, 13, 14 years of age, if you're having cats presenting to you that are younger, 5, 6, 7, do think about looking for ureteral stone formation in those cats. Don't miss that. If you palpate the kidneys in a sort of middle-aged cat and they're asymmetrical, think straight away, should I be looking for stone disease in this cat? But they're potentially very different pathophysiologically. And I think that's something which is of great interest at the moment and which I have colleagues who are exploring. So yeah, that would be, I think, an area where we may see some future information coming through.
Fabulous. It is inspiring how much research has come out of the RVC and your really active group. So thanks for sharing that latest little hint of future discoveries. And looking at our original agenda for discussion, I'm thinking really that we have pretty much covered everything on our list. I don't know if there's anything you can think of that we still need to cover.
No, I think we've run through all of our collective knowledge on phosphate regulation in the cat and how we can try and help, I think, owners and vets with this, because I think it is really important, because it's easy to forget that such a simple change, such as transitioning to a diet or using a phosphate binder, actually still is the one thing that has been shown to change outcome in these cats. There are a lot of other supportive things that we can do that are important as well, but this is so key and was such a great finding all those years ago.
Absolutely. I think it's something that I totally echo your words there, because it seems, and I think often to owners, it just seems a bit far-fetched in a way that altering what a cat is essentially taking in through their diet can have such a profound impact on the disease process. But you know, thanks to much of the research done by the RVC in the UK and obviously other centres of excellence, we can say with such confidence, this really is something that you should put your time and effort into, because it will have a phenomenal positive impact on quality of life as well as length of life. It's been great to have the chance to talk about it more with you today, Rosanne, and I hope everyone listening also has gleaned perhaps some new tips or two that to help with future case management. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, Sarah. It's been great to chat today and a pleasure to work with you.
These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon.